Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. Our guest today is Dr. Dan Siegel. Dan is a clinical professor of psychiatry at the UCLA School of Medicine and the founding co-director of the Mindful Awareness Research Center at UCLA. He's also the executive director of the MindSight Institute, which focuses on the development of MindSight, which teaches insight, empathy, and integration in individuals, families, and communities. Dan has published extensively for both the professional and lay audiences. His New York Times bestsellers are Brainstorm, The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain, and two books with Tina Payne Bryson, PhD, The Whole Brain Child, and No Drama Discipline. Other books include The Developing Mind, MindSight, The Mindful Brain, and The Mindful Therapist. And he's here to talk to us today about his latest book, Mind, A Journey to the Heart of Being Human. Hello, Dan. Welcome to the Midway Society podcast.
Thanks, Barry. Thank you for having me.
Great. Well, should we just dive in then, Dan?
Let's dive away.
You structured the book by exploring what you see as the what, who, where, and why, and when of the mind. And I thought it might be an idea to frame the interview in this way. But also, a lot of you was in the book as well. And in a sense, it was part autobiography. I personally found this really fascinating and very moving at times. What was your rationale for doing this?
Well, you know, Barry, when I set out to write a book to connect with people, with the reader, about the nature of mind, one thing that comes up when we use that term mind is subjective experience. So I wondered, you know, before I started writing the book, what would be a way to invite a reader to explore her own or his own, subjective life, the texture of lived life that we experience in consciousness as a beginning place for diving into the mind. And so I felt that for the reader to be invited to be present, I as the writer needed to be present too. And usually in professional books, you're told not to do that, and you're urged to stay, you know, very objective and very professional and all that stuff. So it was a big decision against, you know, a general stance, but I felt really strongly about it. So I tried it out, and it seemed to work when I tested it out with the initial readers of the first versions of the manuscript. And so I went that way, and I thought too that, you know, doing it in a kind of chronological sequence at times, segments of time, you know, would invite the reader also to reflect on their own life and, you know, to try to make sense of life is something the mind does. So it would be, you'd be having the content in many ways parallel the process of the actual reading. So that was the intent behind it, and it seems to have worked okay.
Well, it certainly worked for me. I found that quite helpful. After each chapter, when you'd unpack a certain aspect of something you were trying to put across, then you invited the reader to reflect on their own experience. And I found that really not only useful just as an exercise in itself, but also to get a feel for the book in a better way.
Well, I'm really glad to hear that, Barry, because when I first started out, it wasn't so clear it was such a good idea, because, you know, it wasn't what we're supposed to do. But, you know, hearing your response and having some responses of others makes me feel like, okay, you know, because this is the funny thing. When you write a book about mind, and the mind includes subjective experience, you know, it's a challenge for all of us to do something with that word and also the reality of our subjective lives. So, yeah. I'm glad you found that it worked. And because it also gets into, you know, as you know, some really conceptual discussions that I felt could get so deep and in some ways intricate that to ground it in actual experience, like here I am walking down a street, you know, yeah, this is what the wind feels like, something like that, you know, it would literally ground it on earth while at the same time it's up in the clouds of ideas and interconnected notions, which are also important. They're just different than, you know, the moment to moment experience we have.
Sure, yeah. But it's like anything, like sometimes theory or practice are overemphasized, but I feel them, you know, they're inextricably linked. And I think you did that really well in the book. So I was able to actually sort of think through in a practical way some of your ideas.
Beautiful.
Anyway, once at a public talk, Dan, you said the mind uses the brain to create itself. Then you mentioned in the book that someone in the audience at that time suggested you had made a mistake, as in fact, from his position, it's the brain that creates the mind. Now, I think this in many ways perhaps highlights the standard view of the mind that you, to a large extent, wish to challenge, and somehow goes to the heart of your proposal that the mind is more than simply what the brain does. So what is the mind then?
Yeah, well, yeah, thank you for pointing that out, Barry. That is, you know, the central issue is, you know, since the time of Hippocrates, 2,500 years ago, we've said mind is basically, you know, brain activity. William James reaffirmed that, and it's an understandable position. Of course, you get a knock on the head, and your mind, your feelings, your thoughts, your memories, your perceptions, your beliefs, your hopes, your dreams, all that stuff can be absolutely affected by insults to the brain. So it's understandable that person in the audience would say, you know, you misspoke. It's a brain creates mind. But when you think of the mind as what's called an emergent property, and emergence is a scientific term. It comes from math. It just means that, you know, when you have a complex system built of elements, let's say like a cloud, that the individual elements, like water molecules and air molecules for a cloud, they're what comprise the system.
Yeah.
But an emergent property of the system, let's say, would be the shape of the cloud. And you can't reduce the shape to just the individual elements. So that's what emergence basically means. Something is arising from it, and it is larger in many ways than the sum of its parts. That's the notion. So for me, in reviewing a broad array of sciences and other pursuits that try to study the mind in a disciplined way, it seemed to me the mind was an emergent property of something very particular, which I talk about in the book, which is energy and information flow.
Okay.
And that flow happens between us as much as it happens within us. And the within includes, of course, the brain. But it's not limited to what's in your skull. It also includes what's going on in the body, but it's also not limited by the skin. So it includes what's happening like right now between you and me, but also between us and anyone listening to us. So mind then is an emergent property of energy and information flow. And whether that's consciousness and subjective experience or information processing or a fourth facet of mind, which can be called the self-organizing emergent process that is basically both fully embodied and fully relational. And when you take that view of self-organization, then here's why I responded to that participant the way I did. Self-organization uses the elements of the system to create the movement toward optimal flow. And for self-organization, that means process that we can call integration, linking differentiated parts. So in that way, the mind is going to use culture. It's going to use groups. It's going to use families. It'll use individuals within the couples that are within that family. It'll use the body. It'll use the brain to try to use those aspects of energy and information flow, those locations, if you will, to create self-organization. So that's why I said to him, you know, the mind is using the brain and relationships to, you know, create itself, meaning its ever emergent flow toward self-organization.
Okay. I'm just thinking, you mentioned a couple of times Antonio Damasio in your book, and I'm thinking of some of his studies where he worked with people who, for one reason or another, through lesion or stroke or whatever, had the emotional side of the brain knocked out, and they didn't know what to want. They could be in a supermarket and looking at trying to choose between two types of potatoes, and they could rationalize about it, but they couldn't actually make the decision. And also they couldn't set, people find it very difficult to set goals without emotions. So how does that relate to energy and information? Is that, in that situation with those people, was the energy lacking some desire or something? I'm just trying to unpack how desire and energy and information fit all together.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's a great example. And, you know, even though the terms, you know, energy and information flow are not often used, let's look at Antonio Damasio's example. He often talks about something called somatic markers, which are, you know, the way the signals of the body, like your heart response or your intestines, for example, send through either layer one of the spinal cord or through the insula up into aspects of it doesn't matter the particular, it's the ventrolateral prefrontal region. It comes up there, and there's another area of the parietal lobe that takes in signals from the outside of the body. But you have these very specific regions in the brain that basically are taking these inputs from the body. And one of them, let's just talk about that one, is prefrontal. So if you get someone like Phineas Gage, for example, he talks about who got an injury to this prefrontal region, and somatic markers can no longer be represented, that is, signals from the body represented inside the cortex, then what we would say is there's two things going on there. One, it could be a blockage literally of the action potentials, which are the way neurons fire, which is basically energy flow.
Okay.
And the pattern of that energy often has symbolic value. So symbolic value is a term signifying that the energy pattern has a certain meaning beyond the energy pattern. So if I say to you, for example, London, I'm using sound, but I could say New York, and I'm also using sound. So the slight difference between London and New York are huge information differences. The difference is the pattern of energy. You see?
Yeah.
So in this case, we would say the injury to Phineas Gage blocked both the flow of energy, perhaps, but also the way the cortex, this prefrontal region, was able to extract from the input of energy, assuming it was still coming in, and get information from it. So you could reinterpret Antonio Damasio's beautiful work by overlaying this perspective of mind and say that, you know, here you're looking at the fully embodied energy and information flow that participates in one aspect of where the mind comes from.
That's really interesting. I'd just like to try and unpack the idea of emergence and self-organization a little bit more, if that's okay.
Of course.
I interviewed recently the 2000 TED Prize winner, Sugata Mitra. Anyway, he's a physicist and educationalist, and is most well known for his School in the Cloud project. And he somehow advocates a very similar process going on with learning. And he calls learning, for example, an emergent phenomenon in a self-organization education system.
Mm-hmm.
What I found very interesting, he recently spoke to a crowd of kids about the internet. And these kids were in his cloud project, where they're working together in this relational capacity, again related to your idea of the mind. And he said to them, "So does the internet exist?" And they said, "Yeah, of course it does." And they said, "Well, where is it?" And that slowed them down a bit. And it's that they came up with the idea that we're it in a sense. And then he said, "Well, does it think? Does the internet think? Does it have consciousness?" And I was wondering if you'd saw a connection with the internet and the mind, because he's also studied superorganisms. Is a beehive also emergent and self-organizing?
Yes. First of all, I love his work, and I love the way you're drawing on it to deepen our discussion. And I'm just in the middle of reading two books actually on consciousness in the octopus. who of course has an evolution that as a cephalopod, that is far, far away from our own, as vertebrates. And so they're fascinating, fascinating books. I wish I could remember the authors to give them a little plug here. But anyway, it's two ones that came out very recently. And I bring that up just to say that, we absolutely need to embrace the notion that mental processes, which on one level include consciousness, and the quality of the texture of consciousness is called subjective experience, in addition to information processing, exist within other living beings. So let's just start there in terms of just the animal world, that there's every reason to believe, that these experiences of some kind of mind exist in many different entities. I was once at a meeting with a Parisian philosopher, Michel Bitbol, and we had a wonderful 3-hour dinner where he was talking to me about the neurophenomenologist Francisco Varela, having a conversation with him about the importance of realizing that even an amoeba, processes information. And it was a fascinating discussion.
Yeah.
So when we build on that, and then you're talking about the internet and the way these young students were asked, where is the internet? Who's the internet? When you talk about emergent properties, we do need to realize that if energy is flowing and it's forming symbolic representations that we call information, then it is overlapping with what we're saying is mind. Now, I read, and I wish I could remember her name, a beautiful article by someone about the idea that there's something about intention that is needed to go from simple artificial intelligence to mind. And her argument was that we have the intention to create our communication with each other with in the internet, for example, but the internet by itself lacks intention. So I'm open, I'm open to talking about the whole issue, but she had a really scholarly approach to taking apart the difference between artificial intelligence that might lack intention and human intention. And she had a reason why that was crucial. For myself, I would say this, there's a really useful 4 E's that philosophers of mind have, I think, very eloquently, which would be a 5th E for them, articulated the nature of mind. So they call it embodied, and this includes the work of Evan Thompson, who I love his work.
Yeah.
It's embodied, meaning it's not just in the skull. So it's really embodied. It's embedded, meaning it's relational, is how I would use that term, but it's embedded within, our connections with each other. It's enacted, which means it comes in kind of an action thing. It's not just by itself. It acts on the world and the world acts on it. So it's enacted. And the 4th E is it's extended. So the internet, David Chalmers talks about this, and Andy Clark, in some of their wonderful writings, two philosophers of mind, talk about and refer to many other writers who write about this, that extended cognition is how we have computers, how we have telephones, how we have the internet. And so at least for now, we would say the internet is a form of extended human cognition.
Yeah.
And it would, at this moment, and it may not be that way for long, but at this moment anyway, it requires the intentionality of human beings to make it a part of our extended cognition.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very interesting. Okay, well, let's move on a bit, Dan. You came up with the term mindsight when, as a student, you took a year off from medical school. What does that term mean, and what conditions were in play in your life at the time to help you reach that insight?
Yeah, Barry, this is another reason why I wanted to write the mind book as stories, because some of these experiences I had, I think people wouldn't really believe, but what I would say is this is, when I was in medical school, I was a young student, and I was very excited and eager to be in that training. But when I got to the clinical side, and I would spend a lot of time talking to my patients about their feelings, about what an illness meant in their lives, about how it affected their relationships, about, you know, their hopes for the future, you know, my professors would constantly tell me repeatedly over and over again with a lot of intensity that I was asking inappropriate things, that doctors should not be asking patients about their feelings or their story or meaning or stuff like that. So I ultimately dropped out of school, and in my time away, it was like very confusing because I had wanted to become a physician for a long time. So now I was like without a plan. I didn't know what I was going to do. And when I thought about what had happened there in the hospital and how these really smart professors could treat human beings as if they were mindless, just bags of chemicals. And I was trained in biochemistry, so I was pretty proficient at talking about molecules. I just felt there was something really seriously scientifically and professionally wrong with what they were doing. So I said, well, what's missing is they're not seeing the subjective experience of their patients and how important that is. So I made up this word, mind sight, for the sight is the seeing and the mind meaning at least subjective experience. So mind sight was a simple word I made up for myself. So when I decided to go back to school, you know, it kind of protected my heart, it protected my head, it protected my soul, you know, because, you know, of course the professors hadn't changed and I had to really kind of study these professors like you might study a bad play if you were a playwright, you know, yeah. That what's the way not to treat patients. And even though they're really smart with physical sight, you know, seeing the physical world, they were kind of at least not applying any mind sight skills they had. So it was a word back in the early 80s that became a guiding light for me. And then when I went into psychiatry later on, it seemed that you could teach mind sight to people and it would be actually quite useful.
Yeah, and I remember there was a person in your life around that time that was also a guiding light, your friend and mentor Tom. And I remember there's a great quote in the book. I don't know if it's from him personally, but it was like, if you want to care for people, you need to care about them.
Exactly.
And was he also an influence on you when you started developing the ideas around integration?
You know, I knew Tom when I was in medical school, and I don't think the idea of integration as a clear idea, maybe an experience it was happening, but Tom was an epitome of that. But I don't think I had it conceptualized in my mind during those years, no. But I would say that what I learned from him was that you had to bring your whole self to being not just a clinician, but kind of to being a person in the world. And he really was a mentor to me about that at a time when, you know, trying to fit into that social system of medicine, you had to be the opposite of whole self. So I would credit Tom implicitly with teaching me about integration for sure.
Okay.
It was later on with some things I'd learned about trauma and about attachment and about the brain and ultimately looking at the math of complex systems that and self-organization that integration became really clear in the early 90s.
Okay. And so what is integration, Dan, and how does it relate to the mind?
Yeah, so, you know, the story I tell in the book, the experiences that happened with me with this group of scientists, 40 scientists, asking what is the mind and how is it connected to the brain, they couldn't come up with a definition of the mind that they shared, but they all knew what the brain was. So I offered them a definition that I mentioned to you earlier of a self-organizing, emergent, embodied and relational process that regulates the flow of energy and information. So for them, that was a useful working definition for us to begin back in 1992 to collaborate with each other in a transdisciplinary way. So it was very exciting. As a clinician, I wanted to ask the next question, which is, how do you optimize self-organization from that definition, right? So what became apparent both in my clinical practice, because I had been practicing for many years at that point, was that patients came in with either chaos or rigidity. And when I looked at the math of self-organization, it said that if there's a complex system that's not optimizing self-organization, which I can define how it does that in a moment, it leads to chaos or rigidity. So I was like going, whoa, then maybe that's why all these serious psychiatric disorders like schizophrenia or manic depressive illness or depression or obsessive compulsive disorder, autism, post-traumatic stress, all these conditions, their symptoms are all, you know, examples of chaos or rigidity. So then when I asked the question to mathematicians who are specializing in complexity theory, what optimizes self-organization? They said, well, that's very simple. I said, well, what's the answer? And they go, you differentiate aspects of a system and then you link them. I said, well, give me an example. And they would talk about a cloud, how different regions of the cloud could differentiate, but then link, or even there was a complex system of, I believe they were amoeba, and how they formed this complex system that was self-organizing. So I said, well, what do you call the linking of differentiated parts? What's the math term for that? They go, we don't have a math term. We just say that's how you optimize self-organization. So I said, well, I'm going to call that integration because it seems like that's what it is. They go, well, no, you can't call it integration. And I said, well, why can't I? And they said, because in math, integration is the sum of something. You lose the differentiated features. The key thing for self-organization is you maintain the differentiation plus you add linkage. So yeah. Don't call it integration. Well, I couldn't find another English word for that. You know, it's certainly a form of synergy, but that didn't grab it. So I've used the non-mathematical term integration to define differentiating and then linking. And then when you take that way of defining integration, it turns out that that is how you optimize self-organization.
Okay.
And create harmony, basically.
Yeah. Well, just before this our conversation started, you asked me what the target audience is, and I gave you a rather vague answer. But in reflecting on it now, the majority of people who are listening in to this, Dan, they're interested in the idea of integration.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Whether it be at, you know, an individual level and a personal level or within their community or the wider world. And you suggest in the book and related to this that integration, you could almost see it as a synonym for well-being. And also perhaps it's what gives purpose to life. And it's certainly that's the case for me. We in our society, we have a very, very similar view of integration too. And the chair of our society, Robert Ellis, has written 3 books on integration.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And there's a lot of synergy and resonance. But anyway, so could you just expand on that a little bit more? So why you see that connection with purpose and well-being?
Yeah, well, it's so interesting, Barry, because you know, I was so nervous about doing this in the book, and I think I said so in the book. You know, it's like, how can anyone say what the purpose of life is? It's such an individual question.
Yeah.
I did it very hesitantly, but when you do the who, what, where, when, how, and then you come to the why, you go, well, I want to include all the 6 interrogatives, you know, that we have. So I said, okay, well, if it's true that the mind is, in one facet of it, is this self-organizing, emergent, embodied, and relational process that regulates energy and information flow. Then you say, well, what's that self-organization there to do? You could say, well, it's actually there to create integration. I mean, that's actually how self-organization, you know, in the math terms, it says maximizes complexity. It's how it creates harmony. It's these 5 features of being flexible and adaptive, coherent is a math term for holding well together over time, energized and stable. So therefore, if we live in a body and we have a mind, it's reasonable to at least propose the question, could it be that the why of mind, the purpose of mind, is to optimize self-organization, because it is a self-organizing process, is the proposal, then you go, well, if that's true, then the way you would do that is you would create integration wherever you could. And that's why I said to that participant, the mind uses the brain basically to create integration when it can. And I think it's why, you know, in our world today, you see so much distress, because a lot of the proclamations coming out of the country I live in, you know, from the government, you know, suggest that differentiating may not be the way to go. So we want to really, really look deeply at the question of, you know, who are we as a human species, and how can we support each other in our differentiated nature, and move ultimately toward what integration reveals, which is kindness, caring, and compassion.
When I reflect on your work over a number of years, Dan, you've, in many ways, you challenge certain dichotomies or dualities such as reason and emotion, and to an extent, facts and values. Thinking about it in that way, if integration equals the purpose of life to a large extent, does it then have a moral aspect in the sense that more integrative decisions are perhaps more moral decisions, and more integrative people are, in a sense, more virtuous?
Well, that's very interesting. You know, I would say that it does have a moral dimension to it. If by morality, well, I could ask you what you mean by moral, because I have a way of dealing with morality. So let me ask with a question to you, Barry. Tell me what you mean by moral when you say a moral dimension.
I suppose morality is a hard one to pin down, but morality is about making. This is just the top of my head, right? Making better decisions that take in the bigger picture and making as balanced a decision as possible. It's I suppose it's you know, like you've talked a lot about kindness and compassion, but wisdom is in there too. And I think wisdom is, I think they're all interconnected. So I've given you a rather woolly answer there, but I think.
Okay. Well, you know, I would go with your woolly answer, and I would also add, perhaps, you know, the idea that for me, morality means embracing not only issues of right or wrong, but realizing, you know, we're part of a larger whole.
Yeah.
And, you know, and in doing that, then yes, this is directly related to that sense of, you know, for example, if you say for an action you're examining for its moral basis, you say, you know, does this promote well-being or does this promote chaos and rigidity? And if you say this action, this decision, this policy is creating more chaos or rigidity, not just in the short run, because to change, we need to go through periods of disorganization, but I mean in the long run, then you would say, well, you know, there's something about this policy or this action that is actually either amoral or possibly even immoral. And so that's, it's an interesting, and very direct, way of looking at things from a moral basis. And I'm not a philosopher of morality or anything, but it seems in what I've read about that this might be a useful kind of measure of morality is, does it promote integration or does it inhibit it?
Yeah, that seems to work for me. There's nothing jars about that connection between the two spheres, really. Anyway, well, let's move on to who. How did getting dragged by a horse help you understand who you are?
Yeah, you know, that's such a strange experience. And you know, when I was just about to turn 20, I was working for the World Health Organization, and on my work day, I was going to interview a folk healer, and the saddle of the horse fell to the horse's belly, not fell, it got loose, and it turned to the horse's belly, and my feet stayed in the stirrups of the saddle, which meant that the horse continued galloping, but I was being dragged, and my head and face were being knocked repeatedly for a long, long time, over 100 yards, about 100 meters. And when it stopped and my compatriots came to me, they thought I would be dead. And they thought maybe if I wasn't dead, I had at least broken my neck. So neither of those things happened. But what happened was, you know, I destroyed a lot of things, my teeth and everything, but I lost my identity for a day. And I was wide awake, very aware. Things had a different quality to them during that 24-hour period. And I remember it very well. It was like being a little kid who was like discovering things for the first time, you know, and everything was had this kind of very luminous quality to it. It was very, I don't know how to describe it, very fresh, you know, very, very alive, very, it just felt very engaging. And, you know, when my identity came back and that those qualities sort of subsided, I figured that it was some kind of either, you know, brain injury that made me lose my identity, or maybe afterwards, you know, the changes that were there in me were existential changes because I almost had been killed or something. I don't know. Yeah. So I never really thought about it until about 25 years later or more, actually. And I said to Jack Kornfield when I first met him, we had lunch, and he said, "How'd you learn about this idea of mindfulness?" Because I had never meditated or anything before in my life. And I just happened to, for some reason, tell him this story, which I never really told anybody about. And he was just like really focused on what I was saying. And he later called me up. He says, do you know what you did? I said, "What do you mean?" He goes, "You just fell into what people spend decades trying to achieve by meditating." So I said to him, "Why would someone want to break their teeth and their nose meditate? I don't understand what you're talking about." He goes, No. And he's laughing. He said, you don't understand what I'm talking about." I said, "Worse than not understanding it, what you're saying to me makes no sense. What are you talking about? Why would someone want to lose their identity?" Anyway, we developed a friendship after that. So I learned in studying with him that, in fact, the idea of a fixed identity is indeed something that in various contemplative practices you try to loosen. And so I put it in the book because, you know, in my own personal experience, indeed, you know, literally, you know, having accidentally encountering this lack of identity did change my life. I mean, it really let me loosen up taking myself too seriously to a certain degree. I'm sure my family and friends wouldn't agree, but, you know, I know myself from the inside out, so I can tell you it's true. You know, and the difference, it isn't so much a difference of enthusiasm in life. It's more like having a certain perspective that personal identity is not the whole of who we are.
Yeah.
So that's why it's in the Who chapter, because it's the beginning of a bigger discussion of, like, you know, if we restrict our identity to the name that our parents have given us and the body that we're living in, or even worse, the head that we have, you know, we're actually going to limit our capacity for integration in our life, for opening up a sense of awareness, a sense of identity, a sense of connection that, you know, when you see people open that up to a different way of existing, you can embrace a personal identity as real. So I'm not saying it's an illusion, but the belief that it's all of who you are may be a restrictive belief that is a kind of illusion, or Einstein called it a delusion of our separateness.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. That's a great quote as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is this related to what you describe as beginner's mind in the book in any way, that experience you had?
Yeah, I would put it right there with beginner's mind, in the sense that there's in beginner's mind, my understanding of it is, there's a way of having what in the book I call, you know, bottom up experience, where you let things be experienced as if for the first time, the beginning of something.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, it certainly is related to it, I think. And then you also have, you know, what's called the burden of expertise, that once you become an expert in what a dog is and you have a name for dog, next time there's a canine cousin coming by, you know, you don't pay it much mind. You don't pay it much attention because you know what a dog is, but then you don't really see what's in front of you. So part of beginner's mind is this invitation to learn how to drop beneath your knowledge structures and your expertise and gain insight into as close as we can, you know, what you call presence, pre-sensing. You know, it's tough because you have a brain and you do have knowledge, you do have experience. So it is a kind of art form, I think, to try to develop this beginner's mind, to really allow the who of who you are to be more open than a restrictive definition of who you think you are.
Yeah, okay. So let's move on now to where the mind's located, Dan. So how is the mind not only embodied, but also embedded? Could you just unpack that a little bit more?
Absolutely. So this is the tough thing about, you know, in academics, there's such a focus in neuroscience and psychology and psychiatry on the interior origin of mind. And so, you know, even if you move from the head, which a lot of people don't want to do, into the body, you're still in the within location of the mind, you know. So this presents a very interesting intellectual challenge, academic challenge. But from a practical point of view, what it means is that the mind, you know, our feelings and our thoughts, our consciousness, our subjective experience, information processing, but especially if you look at self-organization, that the mind is not limited by skull or skin. This is the idea. Once you say it's energy and information flow, you're given a very clear scientific framework with which to say that energy and information flow is not limited by skull or skin, and therefore, if the mind is an emergent property of energy and information flow, which is what the proposal is, then the system of mind has many, quote, locations in what we perceive as distinct. But rather, we only think they're distinct because we're making artificial boundaries like our skull or our skin. And this is hard for people to grasp. So I wanted to spend, like in all these issues of the here and the where, you know, I wanted to spend really some time going through it to, you know, wrestle with these ideas. Where is the mind? Well, it's both within you and between you and the world. So that's the idea.
Okay. Oh, and what role do you think the right hemisphere sort of plays in seeing this in between us, perhaps? You talk about the hemispheres in your book. Do you think that one hemisphere plays more of a role there?
Well, that's really interesting, you know, because these days you have to be very careful over generalizing about right and left with the new studies that are out. But there's certainly a right mode and a left mode, even if they use both sides of the brain. Yeah. And those modes are pretty distinct, and they seem to be all mutually inhibitory. So I would say, yes, there seems to be a left mode, which likes things to be very distinct, yes, no, up, down, right, left, right or wrong. And it would have a hard time saying, well, mind needs to be in one location. People have different bodies. And if I'm going to think in those ways, it just makes me feel very nervous, you know. So there is a left mode that probably prefers that kind of more linear way of attributing cause effect that is dominant in the left mode. The right mode, in contrast, it feels more comfortable in a sense with systems thinking.
Yeah.
And systems thinking is it's real. I'm working with a bunch of systems thinkers now in a project to see how we can promote more systems thinking in a world that's really more linear thinking of this left mode dominance. Because if we're going to realize our place on the planet, we need to embrace the reality of how interconnected we are in the system. So anyway, so a right mode, just, and that isn't just right hemisphere, that's just a right mode processing, does have this more systems orientation. So in that sense, feeling the mind in the betweenness is a part of a larger system, and it may take systems thinking to allow systems perceiving. That's the idea of that.
Okay, why is it important to ask the question why we have a mind?
Well, you know, when you go through all these, like the who are we? Well, we're more than our, you know, more than our individual identity. The what are we? We say an emergent property of energy and information flow. We've said where, within, and between. We've said, you know, how the mind works. We said it works when it's integrating, it works really well. And when it's not, it goes to chaos or rigidity. We didn't touch yet on the when, but we can just say there's a fascinating when of mind, you know, that allows you to see how important the present moment is, especially in light of some of the recent discoveries that time is something that flows, may not actually be something that really exists, but change certainly happens. So there's something called an arrow of time, which is really the directionality of change. So you get some really interesting things even with the when.
Yeah.
And when we come back to this question of why, when you look at all these other five interrogatives and say, well, look, the present moment is really important. Diving beneath separate identity is important. Realizing we're part of a larger system. Our well-being on the planet depends on our embracing our interconnectivity. All of that comes under this question you're asking, Barry, of why.
Yeah.
And it really comes down to this notion that, well, integration may be the why. So like I'm listening to these wonderful, wonderful talks on contemplative studies, and they're talking a lot about kindness and compassion. Well, kindness and compassion are integration made visible. And even though these speakers who are speaking so eloquently are not talking about integration, they don't talk about energy and information flow, they're not offering definitions of the mind, their beautiful work can be brought into this larger, you know, mindsight view or this interpersonal neurobiology view of, you know, saying, well, gosh, yes, living in the present moment is essential. It's the pathway or portal for integration to arise. And when we embrace the openness of that, kindness, compassion, and caring are natural ways that we can learn to live. And so this is, for me, the why of mine. It helps me in my own personal life. It's, I think, it's another reason why I wanted to make sure the book invited readers to take in the ideas, but also see if they could weave them with their own, you know, personal journeys. Because as Arthur Zients said in a meeting I was at recently, you know, we need something, he coined this term, pervasive leadership. We need people to take on, literally from the inside out, inner knowledge, inner awareness, so that they can bring from this space of really inner integration, I would say, a way to be in the world that is ready to receive a different kind of way of being. Because if everyone takes on this kind of leadership invitation, there can be all these changes that can happen.
Sure.
So that's, I love his notion of Arthur Zients' notion of pervasive leadership. I think it's a guiding light that we all need to work on, doing podcasts like you're doing, Barry, having societies in different places that try to bring these messages in, you know.
Yeah, I would very much agree with that. And in your book as well, you start to make a connection between integration and the world's wisdom traditions.
Mm-hmm.
Could recognizing that this idea of mindsight, or that we are aware, be seen in some ways as also being a sacred experience?
Yeah, you know, Arthur had a beautiful way of defining what sacred means. And I wish I could quote him in all his eloquence. And I may have done it in the book, I can't remember. But right now, I'll just give you the gist of it. It was something like, you know, something sacred for him meant like honoring the beauty of the world and having this sense of gratitude for what is, something like that. It was much more beautiful than that. But what do you mean by sacred, Barry? So I can know how to respond to your question.
I'm not sure how to pin that word down myself either. It's something that,
okay.
I suppose if someone were to ask me what the term the religious sensibility is, maybe coming to terms on reconciling oneself with one's existential condition, and crucially, it's not positing final answers. I really like that,
yeah.
The idea of coming to terms with, you know, embracing the suffering and the joy in our life and all the complexity of it. So
yeah.
When I get into that sort of one, if you can embrace that, there's a sort of sacredness there. I don't know.
Yeah, I love that. You know, it reminds me of a dear friend, John O'Donohue, who was also a colleague. We used to teach together, and he would use the word sacred a lot. And around that time, people were inviting me to teach at conferences I never knew existed on spirituality, you know. And I would say, what's spirituality? And they said, it's meaning beyond survival and connection beyond your skin.
Oh, that's
and
brilliant.
And say, wow, meaning and connection, great. And I think John O'Donohue would have embraced the idea that, you know, a sacred life would include those things. In addition, and this gets to what I think you're saying, Barry, John used to always call himself a mystic, and his students, his fellow mystics. And I said, John, what's mysticism to you, you know? And he would say that it was embracing the reality of the invisible. And, you know, for me as a scientist, the idea that the perceptual apparatus that our body gives us is quite limited is a natural scientific humility to take. So that the invisible, the unseen, is quite likely very real.
Yeah.
And so for John, being a mystic says, you know, I recognize that my body is limited, but that reality is much more complex than either what my body can see. So I honor the invisible, or even my brain might be able to comprehend.
Sure.
So I think to really embrace fully the sacredness of everything we're talking about, the mysticism of it, the spirituality of it, is to be truly scientific.
Yeah.
So I don't see a division between science, spirituality, the sacred, and the mystic.
Yeah, and I think you do it really well in the book when you talk about our name as a species, Homo sapiens sapiens, the ones mm-hmm. who know. And you say in some ways that marries the notions of both science and spirituality. I thought that was great.
Yeah, exactly. And that's my deepest hope for the book, is that it can allow us in all these different fields of the sacred, of mystical, of spirituality, of religion, even of, you know, contemplative practices and of clinical work, education, parenting, science, that people will find a common ground there because they're all invited to participate themselves.
Yeah. Okay. No, great. Yeah. Okay. My last question, Dan. The middle way, as we understand it, is the idea that we make better judgments by avoiding fixed or dogmatic beliefs about things, whether those beliefs are positive or negative. That then throws us back on experience. So we're left in this sort of messy, uncertain middle. But it's arguably in the messy, uncertain middle that we actually start to get to grips more adequately with the phenomena that we encounter, whatever they are. Now, how might that relate to what we've been talking about today?
Yeah, well, I'll just say this, that I think, you know, and I think I talk a lot about this in the last three chapters of the book, about the importance of embracing uncertainty. And so just to spend a moment really honoring what young children and adolescents go through, you know, in the school environment in modern times, it's so much about certainty, right? I mean, you have an exam, there's a right and wrong answer, you know, you're supposed to know exactly what's going on. You take your test, you get scored. And yet life, as you're beautifully pointing out, Barry, is messy. It's full of uncertainty. And I think what we need to do, and I think when I, back in the day when I was offering this working definition of the mind, I kept on telling the participants in that group, it's a working definition. There's no reason to think it's correct or not correct. But, you know, when I had my first book, Developing Mind, under revision, I had 15 interns work with me. And I said, your task is to prove that what the first edition said was completely wrong. And let's just write a new book. It'll be more fun. They go, you mean prove it's right? I said, no. you want to disprove something. Anybody can find one or two things that supports you. Yeah. I want you to find one or two things that just go against it. And then we'll move on, you know. And so it was a fun little journey we had. But the issue there is exactly what you're saying. You want to put out a possible idea, like the mind is a self-organizing process, and then say it could be wrong. And let's find the things that prove it wrong. Well, so far, over the last 25 years, the research that's come up support that view, but we still should have an open mind about it. However, you can start building some interventions, some things you do, parenting approaches, education, clinical work, climate change issues, things you do, you know, with your own contemplative practice that build on integration. Because for now, anyway, we have 25 years of empirical support for it, but you wouldn't want to use the word proven, and you'd always want to leave an open mind about the uncertainty of everything, for sure. And that actually makes it, for me, more exciting. It's just, you know, when you really embrace uncertainty, life gets a certain, well, it's the beginner's mind thing. You say, let's just keep a fresh mind as best we can. And I think that's a way of joining any relationship with anyone, is that, you know, it's not that we don't know anything. It's just that we can be in a state of continually learning new things.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, yeah. While I personally think it's a good strategy, and it seems like you as well, to avoid certainty, that doesn't mean to say that you can't have an incremental confidence in something. You know, confidence is an incremental term. And I certainly, through reading your work, Dan, have a lot, not only a lot of confidence in your work in general, but also in this idea of the mind. And I hope through this chat today that some of the listeners have got at least a, because all you can do in a talk like this is get a snapshot, but maybe they'll have encouraged them to go out and buy your book.
Well, great. And I don't know where you're located, Barry. I know I'll be in London later on in the spring. And it'd be lovely to continue a conversation.
Brilliant.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.